Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to another exciting day of coronavirus and social distancing and quarantine and all those wonderful things that that we are getting to experience in our lifetimes. So we are going to continue this morning our study going through the Bible. We are, in case this is new to you, we are going through the Bible and we're picking up some of these smaller stories that we skipped over as we made our way through the Bible initially. We're taking a two-year trip through the Bible, and these are some of the stories, some of the passages that we missed. And now that we have a little bit of extra time because of coronavirus, we're going to go back through and we're going to look at these stories in detail. And that's what we have been doing for the past 2 weeks, and that's what we're going to continue to do as we move through this time of social distancing and quarantining. This is an opportunity for us to all hone our biblical knowledge. All of us can really, you know, work on our Bible study skills and get better. And hopefully this will be a worthwhile experience. So if you have your Bibles, please open to Genesis chapter 42, Genesis chapter 42. And if you have not read the text yet, which obviously how would you have, because I haven't told you, but if you haven't read the text yet, go ahead and pause, read the text, and then we'll begin after you unpause. Okay, so we look at this text. Joseph's Brothers in Egypt is the title that the NET Bible gives to this passage of Scripture. And different Bibles are obviously going to give a different title to this, but the NET calls it Joseph's Brothers Make Their Journey to Egypt. Joseph's Brothers in Egypt. So we ask the obvious question of the five questions. That's our model. If you wanna do the five questions, you wanna do the plot chart. This is a great time to do that. Write on your piece of paper. Write your W's. Who, when, where, what, and why. Look at those, because your what, you know, remember your who, your where, your when. Those are your simple background questions. Right, those are the most basic questions you can ask. Your what question is going to give you your plot chart. You're going to go from the beginning where you set your stage all the way up through your rising action to your climax, and then your falling action slash resolution slash denouement, depending on how technical you want to get. So those are the things that you're going to want to do. And then, of course, we have our theological question, which is why. This is the method we're using in these brief daily Bible studies. We're trying to use a minimum of Hebrew. And all I'm using for Hebrew stuff right now, I'm not doing a detailed study of these passages because I want to have these studies be something that you can do. Somebody who is not trained in the original languages, this is something you can do for yourself using good resources, using a good study Bible, using the NET Bible. The NET Bible is really good at giving you the meaning of what's going on in the Hebrew text. So that's why I really strongly recommend using the NET Bible, not because I think it's a particularly good translation, although I think it's a good translation. Actually, translation-wise, I prefer the NIV. The NIV is my favorite Bible to read. It's my favorite Bible to listen to. I think it is the best English of any Bible out there. It just reads really, really well. It is great for memorization. It is great for public reading. I really like the NIV. The NET, I'm not really such a big fan of reading it. I don't think it reads as well, but the notes are just outstanding. The notes are just really cannot be beat. And the NET Bible website is just a really, really, really good website. I mean, it is an outstanding website. I'm not a shill. They are not paying me any money to say these things. I'm just telling you, for your daily Bible study, you can't really get a better price for money value than the NET Bible at netbible.org. I mean, it is free, so it'd be hard to beat it. But really, they have great notes. And they're really worth looking into. So anyways, write down on your piece of paper your five questions, maybe draw your plot chart if you want to do that, and then we're going to dive right in. Who is in this story? Well, we could just scan the text and read. And we could say, Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt. His sons are in the story. Joseph's brothers. So we've got some different names here for some of the people. And this is something that is worth mentioning here. We have Jacob mentioned by name, and then we have his sons. But then they're called Joseph's brothers. Now that's significant, okay? That's significant because these men have different relationships to different people. They're Jacob's sons, but they're Joseph's brothers. And remember, the story here in Genesis, after Genesis 35, after they return to Bethel, you know, you've got the rape of Dinah, and then you've got the return of Bethel, and then really that's when the story of Joseph starts. And Joseph is the main character. He is the protagonist through the end of Genesis, right? So really from chapter 37, from 39, because you have the story. Well, 37, you have he's sent into slavery, right? Chapter 36 is a genealogy. So you have 35, chapter 35, it's there in Bethel. Chapter 36 is a genealogy for the Ishmaelites. Chapter 37 is about Joseph. Chapter 38 is about Judah and Tamar. Chapter 39 is about Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Chapter 40 is Joseph and the cupbearer and the baker. Chapter 41, Joseph becomes the prime minister. And then we get to chapter 42, which is when Joseph's brothers enter back into the story. So really, if you look from chapter 37 on, Joseph is the protagonist. The whole story about Judah, like we talked about yesterday, the story of Judah is there for a reason, but largely the story of Judah is a foil upon which we get a better look at who Joseph is. So notice the difference in the terminology. You have Jacob's sons and Joseph's brothers. They're the same people, but they're different titles because we're supposed to see different things. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers. So we have Benjamin. Now, Benjamin is mentioned by name. He's mentioned by name. Israel's sons. Okay, so look at all the different names that we have here for these different people. Jacob's sons, Joseph's brothers, Israel's sons. So we see a lot of names right here. We see, again, the different titles for Joseph's brothers. We see Joseph. We see Pharaoh is now added into the story around verse 14. And Pharaoh is somebody by whom Joseph is swearing, as surely as Pharaoh lives. We see Reuben. Reuben enters into the story. So now Reuben is another person mentioned by name. We've got some servants who are here. They return back to the land. And they know about Joseph, and of course, Reuben opens his mouth again and says something really stupid, but we'll have to get to that later. So we've got our who, right? And what the interesting thing about the who is the different names for the sons of Israel, okay? Now, when is this happening? When Jacob, well, it tells us, the text tells us immediately, when Jacob heard, or more literally, when Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons. So what are we saying? Well, this is about 2 years into the famine, a year and a half into the famine. You know, we don't know exactly when, but this is into the famine already. So this is, Joseph was 13 years a slave, and then you had from 17 to 30, and then you had the 7 good years. So Joseph has been gone for 21 to 22 years now. This is 22 years since Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery. We talked about that a lot yesterday when we saw the chronology of Judah's kids being older and how Judah was probably pretty young himself. A lot of these brothers are not really that old at this point. The brothers at this point are Joseph is 37. His brother Benjamin is probably 35. 33, somewhere in that range, but the oldest, Reuben, is maybe, like I said yesterday, maybe 10 years older than Joseph, so he's maybe 47, maybe pushing 50. I mean, Reuben's maybe pushing 50, but probably not quite even that old yet. And so that's when it happens. Again, I've talked about this at length. The Bible self-references its time. It doesn't reference it to an external event, at least not normally. Sometimes it will later. What we'll see when we look at the Kings and the Chronicles is sometimes you'll get an external referent. And I think that that's interesting because that means that when you look at the history books of the Bible, they are conscious. They are self-consciously writing history that will be remembered, and that's why they're referencing external events. But, you know, that's another story for another day. So we have our who, we have our when. Where is this happening? Well, this is happening between Canaan and Egypt. That's a pretty simple conclusion to draw. So right away, we've got our who, where, when pretty sorted out. Okay, Now our what? Now we have our what. What is happening in the story? And this is where we would do our plot chart. Okay, so you start on the far left side, and you see that things are not beginning good to begin with. So we have our setting, and our setting is that there's a famine. In fact, if you go back, if you don't start in chapter 42, but you begin in chapter 41, verse 53, maybe. Call it 53. And we would read, "The 7 years of abundance in the land of Egypt came to an end. Then the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had predicted. There was famine in all the other lands, but throughout the land of Egypt there was food. When all the land of Egypt experienced the famine, the people cried out to Pharaoh for food. Pharaoh said to the people of Egypt, 'Go to Joseph and do whatever he tells you.' While the famine was over all the earth, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to all the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout the land of Egypt. People from every country came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe throughout the earth. When Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt." So that chapter break is probably maybe not the best place. I would maybe place that chapter break back a few verses and put that in maybe in between verses 52 and 53, but maybe not. I mean, I'm not saying it's the worst chapter break in the world, but it's hard to make a clean division here. You know, this isn't a bad place to put it, but this is a chapter break where this is more of a dot, dot, dot. This is more of an ellipses, maybe even a three dot ellipses, but like maybe a seven dot ellipses, right? Like some time has passed, but really the same narrative is continuing. So Jacob hears about this. We've got our setting. Our setting is they're hungry. There's a famine. They know it. And so he says to his kids, he's like, why are you all looking at each other? like one of you is going to come up with a plan like to make the famine go away. Like you need to go to Egypt. You need to get some grain there. So we have rising action. We have something's happening. This isn't necessarily conflict. I mean, right now we have man against nature conflict. Okay. So we have man versus nature. There's a famine. And so people have to take steps to conquer nature. That's the conflict is with nature. So they're going to go to Egypt where they know that they can get grain. So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain, but Jacob didn't send Joseph's other brother Benjamin with his Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, you know, what if some accident happens to him? You know, so again, Jacob cannot help but pick favorites, and this is a problem for Jacob. Like Jacob really has an issue with this, and you would have thought that Jacob would have learned the lesson from his father that picking favorites is an unhealthy pattern. It's not a good thing for family dynamics, but he doesn't learn that lesson, and he's always picking favorites. Rachel was his favorite wife. I mean, first of all, you shouldn't have to pick favorite wives, right? Like that's part one of the problem, right? Like if you have favorite wives, you know, like that's maybe part of the issue. But anyways, we must move on. So they're going, and the famine is severe. You've got rising action. And Joseph's brothers come and bow down to Joseph, which is a fulfillment of the prophecy, okay? And you have this discussion between them, and then they're like, yeah, we come from the land of Canaan to buy ground. And Joseph says, you're spies. I mean, just without any kind of anything, he's just, you're spies. Well, why? Because he remembers who they are. They don't know him, but he knows them. You know, that's the little did they know. Little did they know is an awesome plot technique. The Bible uses this. Like, for good writers, adding little did he know is a really cool thing because it says the audience now knows something that the people in the story don't know. And we get to see how things play out when they don't understand. They become pawns in the story, and we're watching how they're being manipulated. Little did you know, I'm all yawny this morning. You know, little did they know is a really, really, really cool technique. And when you see little did they know, expect something dramatic to happen. Okay, not dramatic like, oh, I got the vipers, you know, but dramatic in the sense of important action is going to happen to the narrative of the story. And so they say, well, you know, we're not spies. No, we've come to buy grain. And he insists, no, you're spies. And they reply, you know, your servants are from a family of 12 brothers. We're the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is with the father at this time. One is no longer alive. Now this is interesting because from chapter 42 seems to imply that they just volunteer this information. Later, they will say that the man interviewed them or questioned them closely to get that information out of them. Probably that's what the case is. Probably what we see in verse 13 is the result of Joseph giving them very detailed questioning. And chapter 42 is just giving us a rundown of the conversation. Remember, as if I've told you this before, but remember when we see a lot of conversations in the Bible, normally we can maybe not assume, but we can expect or suspect maybe that maybe what we're getting is not the entirety of the conversation. We're getting an important summary, and maybe even a summary of verbatim statements. And we all do this, right? Like, if I have a conversation with one of my children, right, and my wife asks me what we talked about, and I give a summary. Sometimes I'm going to quote my kids verbatim. Sometimes I'm going to summarize what they say. Sometimes if both of my kids are talking, I'm going to summarize the conversation that they both had into maybe a singular statement and say, well, they were saying this. Well, maybe it's not verbatim. Maybe it's understood culturally that what I'm giving is an accurate and representative summary of what my kids were actually saying. So that anybody would say, well, yeah, that's what I was getting at, or that's what I was saying, even if it wasn't the exact words that they were saying. So we have a question, and this is a dilemma in Bible study, right? Because Joseph's brothers are known to be bad actors, right? They sold their brother in slavery after they had planned on murdering him, but they thought that they would get more money out of not murdering him. They're not the most trustworthy people in the world. So when we have a discrepancy between what the text says they say and what they say happened, you're not really sure what to believe. The question is, okay, is Moses giving us all the details in verse 42, in chapter 42, or are we supposed to believe that they just offer this information, they just volunteer this information without any kind of preamble or pressure from Joseph, and later, to get themselves off the hook, they lie to Jacob and say that they were questioned really closely. That's a possibility. So maybe they're just idiots and they offer all this information about their family as a way of saying, like, no, we're honest men. We're from a family of this many people and one of them's dead and blah, blah, blah. And they're just offering this information. And then when Jacob's like, why did you give him all the information? They, not thinking to say, look, Dad, we just tried to give him as much information as we could because we thought maybe the more information, the better. Like, we didn't know he would demand to see Benjamin. That doesn't make any sense. Why would he do that? And instead, maybe they come up with a lie to try to placate Joseph and say, well, he questioned us very closely. So what do we believe? I don't know. I don't know what to believe. My tendency is to believe, given the nature of the conversation, that Joseph was questioning them closely and they give an honest answer back to their father when he questions them. However, knowing the nature of Joseph's brothers, I would not say that it is impossible that in verse 13 they just offer this information thinking that this is, you know, going to placate this Egyptian ruler and they don't think about any possible future consequences. So you can draw your own conclusion, and I'm sure that, you know, this is going to be something that we're not going to solve until we get to the other side of heaven. But, you know, is it really an important thing? No. This text is not a very important text for biblical study. However, understanding the difference between there's a term, two terms that are used in Bible study called ipsissima vox and ipsissima verbum. These are Latin terms. Ipsissima vox means the very voice. Ipsissima verbum means the very word, or ipsissima verbum if you want to use the pre-ecclesiastical Latin. So ipsissima vox means it is the very voice. And what that means is, even though the Bible does not quote word for word exactly what was said, it gives us a perfect summary of what was said, so that if any of the if any of them had been asked, is this what you said, they would have said, yeah, that's what we said. Now, we know that it's not the exact words, because sometimes the Bible tells us that there's a summary. And it says, when it says in verse 13, they replied, your servants are from a family of 12 brothers, are we supposed to believe that all of them spoke at exactly the same time and said exactly the same thing, as if, you know, they're the Von Trapp family, like, giving their answer? No. I think that when we see things like they replied, what it means is maybe one person says one thing, one person says another thing, and there's talking over each other, and they're trying to get attention of Joseph so they can put their two cents in. And this is a trustworthy summary of what they're saying, or picking highlights out. So when we see statements like they replied, my tendency is to say that that's probably most likely ipsissima vox. It's the very voice of what was said. Okay, it might not be the exact words, but it's an accurate and trustworthy and faithful and divinely inspired summary of what was said. Okay, then we have ipsissima verbum, and ipsissima verbum means, or ipsissima verbum, or ipsissima vox. Ipsissima verbum is, this is the exact words. These are the exact words that were spoken. And so we look at Joseph, and Joseph says, it is just as I said to you, you are spies. I mean, are those the exact words that came out of Joseph's mouth? I am a person who tends to believe that unless I have a reason to believe otherwise, I believe that these are the very words. That the Bible gives us a verbatim representation of what was said. Now, sometimes not, but I think our default should be to believe that we're getting a verbatim representation of what was said. The words that the Hebrew text gives us are the words that were spoken by the characters in this, unless we have a reason, unless we have an overriding reason to say something else. So recognize those two terms, those two thoughts, ipsissima vox, ipsissima verbum. These are important. Is the Bible giving us the very words of God, or the very words of the characters, or are we getting the very voice? Are we getting the exact words, or are we getting the exact meaning? Now, you can believe in biblical inerrancy, you can believe in biblical infallibility, you can believe in biblical inspiration, you can believe in the authority of the Bible, and believe in both. But you don't have to give up inspiration, authority, infallibility, or inerrancy to hold either of these. But my tendency is to lean towards it is verbatim. These are the words, unless we have a reason to believe otherwise. Okay, that was our second rabbit trail today. I promise to try to keep down the rabbit trails. Okay, so Joseph says, this is how I'm going to test you. Let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go back and feed your starving families. And then if you bring back your other brother that you talk about, then, you know, I'll release your other brother. And I'm doing this because I fear God. And then we get to verse 21, and now we've got, I mean, this is really the climax, right? This seems to be the climax, right? Like, one of them is in prison, and the rest of them are really struggling to know what to do, and verse 21 is one of the most heartbreaking passages in the Bible, verses 21 through 24. They said to one another, surely we're being punished because of our brother, because we saw how distressed he was when he cried out for mercy, but we refused to listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. So they're saying, God is punishing us. God is punishing us. We deserve this. This is the punishment we deserve, because we know that what we did to Joseph was wrong, and this is the punishment we deserve. And Reuben says, didn't I say to you, don't sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen, and now we must pay for shedding his blood. Now, they don't know Joseph can understand them, because he was using an interpreter. He didn't want to give away that he was a Hebrew, and he turned away from them, and he wept. And he came back, and he had Simeon taken from them and tied up before his eyes. I tend to think that Simeon was maybe the ringleader. And I have a couple reasons for that. One, because Simeon is the guy he has put in prison. Secondly, Simeon, we already know, is a pretty violent dude, right? In the incident with the rape of Dinah, it was Simeon and Levi who came and butchered the city of Shechem. So we know Simeon has a violent streak. Simeon is not afraid to shed blood. Simeon is not afraid to do murder. He's not. He is a murderer. And so the fact that Simeon is taken and tied up before their eyes, and he's the one put in prison, that probably should tell us that maybe Simeon had a little more to do with Joseph's the plot to murder Joseph, and Joseph being sold into slavery. So, So we have this climax, right? At least it seems to be a climax. And by the way, a lot of times stories, if you look at a big narrative, you don't really have a straight checkmark line. A lot of times what you have is it looks more like a mountain, like more like if you took a saw blade, right? And you take a saw blade and you tip it up, you would notice that there are a lot of little up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. But the general trend is up. So the plot is going where you have lots of mini stories and mini, mini stories within a story. But the general trend is towards rising action until there's an overall resolution. And then you would see falling action that maybe has a little bit of a W-shaped falling action. Or continuous Vs, whatever you want to call it, a zigzag line. And sometimes we see this in the Bible, obviously, because we're looking at story after story after story of the Bible and saying each one of these has its own plot arc, its own plot chart. You know, it's got its upside down check mark of plot that we're following. And that's in the Bible, right? So sometimes we actually see this within smaller stories. And I think we see that in this smaller story. Within this smaller story, we see this check mark rising and rising and rising, and it seems like every step of the way something happens and there's like this mini climax. And then we see another one in verse 27. So they go and they get there for the night and they look and they see that their money is in the mouths of their sacks. They've gotten all of this grain and now their money is there. And so they see this money and they are terrified. And they say, what has God done to us? What has God done to us? They believe that God is punishing them. Now that they have all their money, they're going to look not only like spies, but like thieves. So they go back to Jacob in the land of Canaan. They tell him everything. And Jacob is just furious. He's nonplussed. He doesn't know what to do. And he's like, you are not taking Benjamin. You are not taking Benjamin, so he says you're making me childless. Joseph is gone, Simeon is gone, and now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. Joseph is in the place where he says, or Jacob is in the place where he says, everything's against me. The whole world is against me. He came to the conclusion that Hank Williams did, that he'll never get out of this world alive. You know, everything is against me. That is where Jacob is. And Reuben says to his father, and by the way, this is just one of the worst things in the Bible right here. Just one of the absolute worst. Reuben said to his father, you may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him, that's Benjamin, back to you. Put him in my care and I'll bring him back to you. But Jacob replied, my son will not go down there with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. If anything happens to him on the journey you may have to make, then you will bring my gray hair down to the grave in sorrow. Reuben comes with possibly the worst possible response. He's like, Dad, if I let another one of your sons die, you can murder two of my kids. You can murder two of your grandkids. Like, what? Like, I don't know if they had crack back then, but like, Reuben, are you smoking crack? Like, how is that going to make anything better? Why would that even be a thing that you would offer? Like, you're offering your sons as surety for your brother? Like, that is just horrifying. That is just absolutely horrifying. Now, what do we notice about this story? Yeah, that's right. No resolution. No resolution. This is a cliffhanger. All we have is rising action, rising action, rising action. The story tapers off with Reuben saying, with Jacob saying, no one, you're not sending Benjamin down. He's just given up Simeon for dead. Joseph's gone, Simeon's gone, you're not going to kill Benjamin. And the story ends with Reuben making this monumentally cruel and stupid comment. And this is a cliffhanger. There's if you drew your plot chart, right? Like, it's not a downward falling action because there's no resolution. Nothing has been fixed in this story. In fact, everything has gotten worse. All we have here is rising action. It's been a zigzag rising action, but there's no resolution to this. And if we look, you're going to go through chapter 43 and chapter 44 before you actually see a resolution to this story. This is a long narrative of rising action. So you see all the way through chapter 45, all the way, well, through chapter 44, you see the end, at the end of chapter 44, when Judah offers to give his life in place of Benjamin's. That's when we see a resolution to the story. But that means that we've got all of chapter 42, all of chapter 43, and all of chapter 44. And really, chapter 44 ends, and we don't know what the ending is going to be. We don't know that Joseph is going to reveal himself, and he's not going to demand Joseph's life. We don't know what Joseph's response is going to be. So we've got three chapters of rising action and building drama, and the Bible is great at this. If you have the time, which you do because it's coronavirus, right? If you have the time, go through and read the Joseph narrative again. It is a wonderful story. You don't have to read the resolution, although I would recommend reading the resolution. I would really recommend reading. Take your Bible, take some time, and read chapters 37 through 50 of Genesis. Read those 13 chapters, 14 really. Read those 14 chapters. It is a remarkable story. It is a remarkable story. And the Bible builds this tension and allows this drama to rise and rise and rise, until you can't take it anymore, and you're brought to tears reading about how Judah, this man who has failed in so many ways, how Judah offers for love of the Father to take the place of the Son. It is a picture of Christ. It is beautiful. It is wonderful. It is glorious. It is worth your time. Take your time now that coronavirus is going great guns, and read the Joseph narrative. It is worth your time. It is worth your time. Anyways, we have to get to why. Okay, why do we have this rising tension? Why do we have this narrative here? And this is a little tough to tell because we have kind of an incomplete narrative, right? Chapter 42 by itself is really an incomplete narrative. So that makes it a little bit more difficult for us to say why we have this story in the text. But here's what, I mean, just looking at it, you could draw a lot of right conclusions. So that, I mean, you can, pretty much anything you come up with, I mean, not anything, but pretty much anything you draw from this is probably going to have a measure of truth to it. And what I want us to do is see that sometimes you can't get the whole picture until you have the whole picture. You can't get the why until you get the whole picture. But this is a good place to stop. This is a section of the Bible. It's an incomplete section, but it's a section of the Bible. And what's the lesson here? The whole lesson here is, everyone believes that God is punishing them. Everyone believes that God is punishing them. We see that the sons of Joseph, the sons of Jacob, believe that God is punishing them for the cruel act that they did against their brother. We see that Jacob himself believes that everything's against me. Everything's against me, he says. Now when he says everything's against me, those are the words of a desperate man. And does Jacob come out and say, I believe God is punishing me? No. But I think it might be implied. We have to recognize that sometimes God does punish. Don't be fooled. God does punish sin in this world. You look at Jacob's life, and Jacob's life is largely a life of paying for his sin. I don't mean paying for his sin in the sense that, you know, he would go to heaven, that his sin would be atoned for, but he suffers for his sin. Joseph has to pay for his sin a lot, right? Just because you're a Christian doesn't free you from the consequences of your sin. There are consequences in this world for sin. Joseph paid a lot of them. His brothers were paying a lot of them. But that doesn't mean that everything that's bad that happens to you is a punishment of God. See, that's the problem, is we're really bad. We are really bad at telling when God is punishing us and when God is not punishing us. I mean, we're really bad at that, actually. Sometimes we think God is punishing us, and sometimes the truth is that God is trying to move us to a place where he can bless us. Now that sounds really prosperity gospel-y. Was God punishing Jacob's sons, or was he moving them to a place where he could bless them? Well, they were certainly being tested by Joseph. Is God involved in this? Is God the one? Well, I mean, certainly seems to be, right? Like, God is the one who put Joseph in his place. God is the one later, what we'll find out that Joseph is seeing nothing but the hand of God in this. Joseph sees the divine hand of providence moving him and his family and putting them in places. So is God seen as a direct actor in this text? No. But God is working behind the scenes here. And that's, I think, what's going on. I mean, what if those Ishmaelites going to Egypt hadn't been walking by? What if they'd been going the other way? What if Joseph would have been sold to Arabia? Have you ever thought about that? I mean, what if he would have gone to Syria? What if he would have gone to any other place in Egypt where he wouldn't have ended up in the house of Potiphar? I mean, God had to organize and orchestrate an awful lot of things to make this work. Is God punishing Jacob's sons? Or is he moving them to a place where he can bless them? Now, maybe there's always an opportunity for a punishment to be a way for God to move you into an opportunity to bless you. I don't know. I mean, that's a deeper theological question than we can answer right at this second, if ever. I don't know that we can ever completely answer that question, at least in this world. Punishments may always be the discipline of God trying to bring you towards repentance, unless it's the punishment of death, and then maybe obviously that's not. But largely, I think we can safely say largely when God is punishing us, if we would have the wisdom to recognize that as discipline and the wisdom to recognize that as God moving us to a place where he could bless us, I think we would see misfortune very differently. I think we would understand pain very differently. I mean, read the book of Haggai. Hey, if you got time, read Haggai. Read Haggai in conjunction with this. You know, in the book of Haggai, the people are experiencing a famine, and they're crying out, and the prophet Haggai comes to them with the word of the Lord, and he says, God says, don't blame nature, don't blame Mother Nature, blame me. I'm the one. I'm the one who has caused the famine because you're worried more about building your fancy houses than building the temple of God. You're more concerned with having nice things for yourself than you are with worshiping me. So I'm the one. Blame me. I'm the one who caused all that you planted to turn out to be little. Now, was this God punishing them for failing to build a temple, or was this God trying to move them into a place where he could bless them? I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, are they? I think that we would all be much, frankly, I think we'd be much happier people. I think we'd be much happier people. I think we'd be much less anxious. And I think ultimately we would be better Christians, more conformed to the image of Christ, if we would recognize that when bad things happen in our lives, that those things, whether or not they're a punishment for sin, is really immaterial. If we view those as opportunities to be moved into a place where God can bless us. If there is sin in our lives, we repent. Now, maybe God is punishing us for that sin. Maybe he's not. Maybe that sin is incidental to what's happening to us. But anytime bad things happen in our lives, that's an opportunity for us to take stock and for us to say, okay, how does God want to change me through this suffering? How does God want to change me through this misfortune? How does God want to change me through this pain and sorrow and sadness? How does God want to change me through this tragedy? How does God want to change me? And that's the question that our country has to ask itself right now. Through coronavirus, through the through what looks like the impending 30% unemployment, through printing $6 trillion in what will almost certainly be a significant drop in the value of the dollar, if not an outright dollar crash. How are we going to be moved into a place where God can bless us through this, what is going to be a medical crisis and then an employment crisis and then an economic crisis? How are we going to be moved into a place where God can bless us? It might not be a place where God can bless us monetarily, but it may be a place where God can conform us to the image of Christ. Brothers and sisters, if we fail to learn to use tragedy as a way to become like Christ, then we will never become like Christ. I mean, frankly, we will never become like Christ. Discipline is painful. All discipline is painful. I went out and ran a couple miles yesterday. It was painful, okay? It was painful. Why? Because disciplining yourself is painful. But disciplining yourself brings a harvest of righteousness for those who are trained. Discipline brings positive results. Right now, we are facing coronavirus. After coronavirus is over, we are going to face major economic problems in this country. major economic problems. Stimulus will not solve these problems. This is an opportunity for us to see our pain and our suffering and these tragedies as a way for God to transform us into who he wants us to be. Always, 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 we need to learn to see tragedy as a means for God to move us into a place where he can bless us. Anyways, I hope and pray we will do those things, and I hope and pray you'll join us tomorrow as we continue moving through the missed stories of the Old Testament, those passages that we have yet to cover. I hope you're enjoying this. I hope that this is a great blessing to you. And yeah, I look forward to talking with you tomorrow. Also, check it out tonight. We have our normal Bible study where we're continuing the rest of the narrative going forward. Tonight, we are going to talk about the fall of Israel. So look for that Bible study to come out later tonight after we get that recorded. So thank you. God bless.